Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hello and welcome to the China Geopolitics Podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham, at the South China Morning Post here in Hong Kong. Today, April 30th, marks 100 days of the Biden presidency. He spoke at length this week about his plans for the next 1,361, but also about what he perceives to be the most serious foreign policy issue. It's China, of course. All of this in a week in which debate raged over China's population. Is it still growing? Why is it important? And why doesn't anybody know the full story? We'll discuss all of the above and more with our sage political economy editors John Carter and Joe Shin. Then in the second half of the show, I'm going to catch up with my colleague in Beijing, Sarah Jung, to discuss the latest chapter in fraught Sino-Indian relations. India is currently in the midst of a crippling coronavirus outbreak, but has refused any offer of help from China. Is this a deepening of the rivalry that saw the two superpowers face off in the Himalayas last year? All that and more in this week's China Geopolitics Podcast.
I spent a lot of time with President Xi. Traveled over 17,000 miles with him. Spent, they tell me, over 24 hours in private discussions with him. He's deadly earnest about becoming the most significant consequential nation in the world. He and others, autocrats, think that democracy can't compete in the 21st century. With autocracies. It takes too long to get consensus. The investments I propose tonight also advance the foreign policy. In my view, that benefits the middle class. That means making sure every nation plays by the same rules in the global economy, including China. In my discussion with President Xi, I told him, we welcome the competition. We're not looking for conflict. But I made absolutely clear that we will defend America's interest across the board. America will stand up to unfair trade practices that undercut American workers and American industries, like subsidies from state to state-owned operations and enterprises, and the theft of American technology and intellectual property. I also told President Xi that we'll maintain a strong military presence in the Indo-Pacific, just as we do with NATO and Europe. Not to start a conflict, but to prevent one.
That was, of course, the voice of U.S. President Joseph R. Biden, and it's fair to say that his first 100 days in office have been slightly more aggressive and proactive, maybe, than I certainly expected, given his rather timid candidacy. He was speaking to the Congress on Thursday in an effort to shore up support for a $4 trillion stimulus package. He cast the U.S.-China relationship as a battle in century-defining technologies and a litmus test of the merits of democracy versus autocracy. I'm joined, as ever, by political economy editors John Carter and Joe Shin. John, I want to ask you how much of this was, in a sense, electioneering from Biden, trying to unite both sides of the aisle, bringing China into the debate in the knowledge that this is perhaps the one issue on which everyone agrees?
Well, it's clearly leverage. I mean, particularly in the Senate, where there's 50 Democrats and 50, well, 48 Democrats, two independents who vote with the Democrats, and 50 Republican. So it's tied 50-50, and Kamala Harris, the vice president, can break ties. But you have to keep the Democrats on side. And there are some Democrats who are not comfortable with Biden's program, particularly the cost. And so using China as leverage, we need to compete with China, otherwise they're going to eat our lunch, is good politics. And this is what Biden is doing, is it keeps everyone focused on that subject, and everything on that subject is support for that subject. And so we'll see how it works out. It's early days. Mm. It will take weeks, if not months, for the Congress to decide on all of this.
Yeah, and Joe Shin, is there recognition perhaps that this is as much domestic politics as foreign policy in China, or do you think they're listening very carefully to these words and seeing it as a setting up of a, it's almost like the Cold War language, isn't it?
Oh, yes, Finbar. I think this is quite interesting because China for a long time has tried to be, you know, by this time and not to be seen as a major rival of the United States on the global stage. But now increasingly China knows that, or China kind of understands that it can no longer do this because, you know, all these phrases when the eternal meetings leaked out saying the you know, the East is rising and the West is in decline. You know, these kind of big assumptions of the historical development. So I think for China, there is a need. It's a similar thing to Biden for its domestic politics. China needs to set up as, you know, the United States is now turning increasingly hostile against us. And we have to stick to our own chosen development paths and do our own things. And we have to prepare for this kind of strategic rivalry against the United States. I think this is the same. And in terms of, but in terms of diplomacy, I see that Beijing is trying to tone down a little bit. You know, at one hand, China is, of course, we're not relaxed. It's preparation for this long-term rivalry. But on the other hand, it is not in a rush to have this real, like, hot confrontation against the United States, so that we can see, like, the balance Beijing is trying very hard to keep. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about a few of the actual, what Biden actually done on China in the first 100 days of his presidency. I think today is actually 100 days in. So human rights sanctions on Chinese officials over Xinjiang. He has upheld the determination that was made in the last day of the Trump administration that the treatment of Uyghurs in Xinjiang constitutes genocide, which is denied by the Chinese government. Rolled out new guidelines for increased engagement with Taiwanese officials. Carried out naval drills in the South China Sea. Also thrown his support behind a massive technology stimulus, which is seen as a way of perhaps rivaling China's own industry. I think it's fair to say, John, that there's more competition, there's more confrontation than cooperation, perhaps even more than we thought.
Yes, and you can add in the new sanctions on restrictions on computer chip exports to Chinese supercomputer makers, which is a big one. There was some talk that Biden would ease off on those trade restrictions. He had done just the opposite. Also, you'll note Catherine Tai, the new U.S. trade representative this past week, said she had no plans to meet with her counterpart in China about potentially easing the trade tariffs. The U.S. is, and she's told Congress that she's going to hold China's feet to the fire to comply with the terms of the trade deal. In other words, buying lots of U.S. stuff. And we'll see how that goes. The latest report says that China's only complied with 60% of those purchase commitments. Mm-hmm. So there's a ways to go. And the U.S. is being as tough and arguably even tougher on China than it was than the Trump administration was. However, there are at the margin, there are signs of light. You have the U.S. easing visa restrictions on Chinese students. You have John Kerry, Biden's climate czar, coming to China and having face-to-face talks with his counterpart. Climate change is one of the areas where people thought China and the mm-hmm. U.S. could work together, needed to work together in order to make progress. Mm-hmm. So there are signs of progress, but clearly the Biden administration is taking a tough stand against Beijing.
Yeah. One thing I'd add that I noticed on Thursday, I believe, that is not directly China related, but shows that the Biden administration hasn't really moved in international terms that far from the Trump administration. At the WTO dispute settlement body meeting, they're still refusing to allow judges to be nominated for the appeals court, so they're still holding the WTO to ransom.
I'm assuming that that's pending reform of the WTO. That's what the U.S., what Trump administration wanted.
Right, but I mean, I don't know how you can reform it
without China agreeing.
Yeah, so
also, if we look at the first 100 days, I mean, from Beijing's perspective, at least, you know, all the best hopes for the Biden administration has been not materialized. For instance, we have only one phone call between the two leaders, and one meeting in Alaska, which basically the Chinese diplomats lectured as the other side, as the other side shouted back, something like that. And then we have this, as John just mentioned, this climate envoy meeting. So there were no, real significant improvement in terms of bilateral relations. There were no developments in terms of rebuilding these usual, Obama days, these dialogues or diplomatic channels. So I say, yes, it's for Beijing. I think they finally realized they confirmed their fear that, whoever is in the White House, the strategic competition between China and the United States will just intensify.
Yeah. And I wonder, Joshin, as journalists, we probably find it a bit easier to cover the Biden administration because we're not waiting for the next tweet. We're not waiting to see what's going to wake us up in the middle of the night. But and I know that it's been written often that the Chinese government, it took them some time to get used to dealing with the Trump administration as well. Is it a bit? Does the fact that it's slightly perhaps more predictable make any difference at all to Beijing?
Well, I think this is more of the tactics, but I think the strategies will have really makes no difference because we don't see any fundamental change from Biden administration's China policy from Trump administration's China policy.
Yeah. Well, the economies are both in various stages of recovery, what should I say? The U.S. economy returned to fairly strong growth in the first quarter. We saw China's growth, of course, skyrocket in the first quarter year on year, but not so much quarter on quarter. John, how do you see the two of them, and how comparable are they in terms of their status?
Well, first, going back to Biden, he did get past the $1.9 trillion stimulus plan, which added to the $900 billion stimulus plan that was passed in December. So there's a lot of stimulus hitting the U.S. economy here in the first and second quarter. And this has pushed up U.S. growth, as you said. Yesterday, the U.S. reported that first quarter growth grew an annualized 6.4%. That's an annualized figure. That's the quarterly growth times four.
So it's quarterly year on year times four or quarter on quarter?
Quarter on quarter times four.
Okay. So we don't know what the year on year, comparable to the Chinese.
We do. It's 0.4%.
Okay.
So it's low. But here's the thing. And compare the 0.4% year over year growth in the U.S. with 18.3% year over year growth in the first quarter in China. Now, China benefited from a very favorable base effect, the contraction of 6.8% in the first quarter last year. In the first quarter last year, the U.S. economy actually grew 0.3%, so it didn't have the favorable base effect. It gets that in the second quarter when the U.S. economy contracted 9.2%, which means it gets even a better base effect. And so some economists are looking for U.S. growth to exceed that of China starting in the second quarter. In the U.S. economy contracted in the second, third, and fourth quarters. The Chinese economy only contracted in the first quarter last year. So the U.S. has this favorable base effect for the rest of the year, and China does not. And so some argue that the U.S. growth will exceed China for each quarter this year and for the whole year, or for the year as a whole. And you can look at the first quarter on a quarter-over-quarter basis, the U.S. growth was already larger than China, 1.6 versus 0.6. Mm-hmm. So this is partly due to special factors. I mean, the first quarter in China, you had the virus outbreak. In northern China, you had the Lunar New Year. And in America, you have all this stimulus suddenly hitting the economy and giving it a big boost. China did that last year. Mm-hmm. So they're starting to taper off their stimulus. So different cycles. The U.S. economy may exceed U.S. economy growth may exceed China this year. It won't in the long run, but it may delay the date somewhat when China economy exceeds that of the U.S., which some people say could be as early as 2028. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. It's I'm glad you explained the difference between the annualized quarterly and year on year. Always throws people, and the headlines don't really compare very well.
No, they don't.
Go back to a university economics lesson.
Yeah, exactly. I wish there was just a standardized way that we all did it.
Figures lie and liars figure. And I'm here to tell you the difference.
I'm glad you are. One of the challenges facing the Chinese economy, Joshin, in the long run will be its demographics. And this was a big story this week. The Financial Times ran a midweek story saying that according to China's 10-year census, which has not been released, there would be a drop in the population in the last year, which would be the first for almost 60 years. However, the National Bureau of Statistics came out with a one-line statement on Thursday saying this is not true. The population is still growing. We still don't have further details on that. We're waiting for the numbers. But first of all, Joshin, maybe where is this confusion coming from? Why are they not just releasing the numbers?
Well, exactly. I mean, the National Bureau of Statistics has conducted this census last November, and it is conducted on a nationwide basis and also, being helped a lot by modern technologies. You know, for these days, it's much easier just to input the number of the people into the one system, right? They developed this special app and for these people to do the job. But it takes longer than the 10 years ago, actually, to produce the numbers. So this raised lots of suspicions, like, what's the problem? You know, why the delay? And today is the last day of April. And already, it's breaking China's own promises. For instance, when they started this census, and the national committee of this census will say, okay, the rough schedule is we will release the result in April. And of course, the National Bureau of Statistics said earlier that it will be released in the first 10 days of April. Of course, they missed a deadline. But still, you can see it's very it's a high sensitivity behind this. Because, it's very interesting that the Financial Times break the story saying there would be the first drop in Chinese population for a long, long period of time. Of course, it's just wrong, saying it is the first since 1949. China actually reported population drop in 1960 during the Great...
61.
And in 61, yeah. During the Great Famine. And then, more interestingly, is the MBS coming out with one statement to defy this this report, saying, no, our population kept growth last year. But this is no point, right? Everyone knows, like, you can say, like, 2020, you still maintain the population growth, but how about 2021? Mm-hmm. How about the 20?
Yeah.
So the Chinese population is peaking. If not the last year, it could be this year or next. It's much earlier than expected. The trends are already there. There are, the new buses has been dropped possibly below 10 million last year. And the society, the whole society is aging so quickly that few, human being society have ever witnessed. And I don't think the Chinese government or the Chinese society has been well prepared for this wave of aging population. Mm. It will be much faster and on a larger scale than Japan. And also China's economic development level or China's preparation, China's family wealth are in nowhere to compare, Japan in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. So this is really a serious problem that could hinder China's long-term economic growth. Yes.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, why is the number so sensitive? But I think you've already answered that question. John, how much of a issue is this for the economy? We saw the People's Bank of China come out with some recommendations. I think that they were even maybe softly recommending opening up to some more immigration and so on. So this is clearly something that runs very deep.
Yeah, no, almost an alarming report by the PBOC and saying, you need to get the population up or it's going to erode the country's economic outlook badly. And this is when I first came to China in 2006, this is one of the themes that China had to get rich before it got old, because even then they knew this was coming. And China has gotten rich to a point, but is it rich enough in order to afford this, the rapid aging of society that Joshin just described? We'll have to wait and see. What we think we know is, even though the population reportedly now rose in 2020, we are quoting demographers saying that by 2022, so in 2 years, the population will start to decline. That's 5 years earlier than previously expected. And the problem that Joshin talked about, this rapid aging of society, the costs that are involved there. Older people don't spend as much money as younger people do. This all affects the population. They're not employed. They don't have to buy a house. They don't have to buy a car. They already have all that. There is a rise in medical care, but it doesn't offset the other purchases of big ticket items. And so this erodes your economic potential. And what does it mean for China in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? We don't know yet. But it's starting soon, and it will have a major impact. And it will affect a whole series of policy initiatives. The two-child policy, which was implemented 5 years ago, hasn't been that successful because the Chinese have gotten used to having one kid, and the cost of living in the big cities is high. And so having a second child is prohibitive. Mm-hmm. Now, Joe-Shin has two kids, but he lives here in Hong Kong.
Even more expensive. but I mean, one thing that is so sensitive, because Fingba, this is the family planning policy has one political implications for the ruling Chinese Communist Party, right? One perception is that, oh, the Communist Party is so great at long-term planning things, while the Western politicians only focus on the polling for the next quarter or next month. The Chinese leadership can plan for the country for the next 10, 20 years. And so this is a planning that, you know, has been going on for decades. And then at the end of the day, you know, people gradually realize that, you know, the costs of this policy has been significantly being underestimated. Mm-hmm. Or this policy has been implemented for too long and also too extreme. Mm-hmm. When I was a child, you know, this was happening in China, and it's called one veto. You know, if you are a town chief, for instance, managing an area of thousands of people, you know, if there's one household that's breaking the family planning rule, if they have an extra child, you know, as a town chief, your bonus or your promotion would be up in the air. So, you know, these are the political pressures. So every government official just putting all the resources to making absolutely sure that the family planning policy is implemented. So if there's a murder, if somebody is killed, possibly, you know, we can, it's still urgent matter, but possibly we can give it a little bit of time. But if there's another pregnant woman is going to give an unauthorized child, this is something bigger than the murder,
wow,
possibly.
Yeah.
And remember in 1990s, exactly 30 years ago, in Shandong province, they implement this inhuman, this horrible campaign called No Child Within 100 Days, which means all my hospitals just cannot allow any new babies. Okay. This is all on the record.
Yeah,
this is why, you know, Chen Guangcheng in the first place get into trouble with the Chinese government. And now, you know, gradually the whole nation waked up that, you know, these kind of things, you know, for sake of control the population, for sake of, you know, to reduce the new buses, maybe, you know, we have been implemented too much. Now China has to face an even bigger project, is to encourage young people to have more babies. And this will be even more challenging. You know, if you look at the experience in Japan, in Taiwan, in Germany, you know, this will be equally challenging.
They break out the oysters and the Guinness.
Exactly. And other policies will be affected too. And there's the government said in its work report that was released in earlier this year, that it would gradually increase the retirement age. This is a very controversial measure because people have been expecting to retire at a certain age and then they can relax. Well, if you raise that age, what you do is they work longer and they contribute longer to the pension funds, which, you know, fund the older people that are already there. But you have to work longer, whether you want to or not. And that is very controversial. This is a big thing. And with Chinese population declining, the second, third, fourth, and eighth largest economies in the world, that's China, Japan, Germany, and Italy, are all, their populations are all shrinking, all developing, or if you consider China for a minute, a developed country, all large economies whose populations are shrinking. What does that do for global growth? What does that mean for the outlook for the world economy?
Fascinating. We could do an entire podcast about. Maybe we should.
Yeah, maybe we should.
Maybe there is.
No. Ask the film. The China's most famous film director, Zhang Yimou. He was fined the record amount of money for having more than one child. Right? He had like three or four kids and being fined like several million yuan because.
Yeah. No such policies in the Catholic.
How did you get away with it, Joshua?
I sent my picture to the leadership.
They're like, please, more of this. Can I just say it's quite alien to me as an Irish Catholic who grew up with with five kids in the household neighbours who had families of much, much larger than this. I mean, it's a really amazing topic.
Indeed.
I'm sure we'll get into it again soon. We will hear more about the census. Do we have an idea when this is actually going to be released? No.
I think the earliest would be middle May.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. The mainland is on vacation next week, so no one expects it then. Uh-huh. The rumors are that it might not be until June. I mean,
they're trying to squeeze out a few more babies.
Or rub down those numbers and make them shine. Oh, my.
Just to finish up, I wanted to run a few things that happened in Europe this week. Three calls in 3 weeks between Angela Merkel and top Chinese officials, having spoken twice with Xi Jinping. This week it was Li Keqiang's turn to talk to the outgoing chancellor, who gave him a gentle nudge, I would say, on human rights issues, while Premier Li urged to keep the focus on areas of cooperation, again citing the fact that there are different definitions for human rights in China and Europe. On Thursday night, it was announced that China's other great friend in the EU, Hungary's Viktor Orban, had held a call with Xi Jinping, in which Xi thanked him for his firm adherence to friendly policy towards China and safeguarding the overall China-Europe relations. I thought that was a great line because, as we know, Hungary is the party within the European Union that keeps blocking all the legislation on Hong Kong.
In each of the 27 nations is able to veto such thing.
You have to have this.
Unanimous
the perils
consent.
Of the European democracy is that every 27, each of 27 members has to agree on everything, which rarely happens. So when something gets done, anything gets done, it's quite an achievement in Europe. All the while, the European Parliament is in session. They've had their plenary this week, and one of the topics of debate was the Chinese countersanctions from March, which were on 10 individuals and 4 entities, very broad and sweeping. We're going to play you a little bit of audio from the European Parliament now. This is Dr. Hannah Neumann, a Green MEP from Germany. The Greens, don't forget, are soaring ahead in the opinion polls in Germany and could be one of the biggest parties after Merkel leaves office.
So I think it is important as a consequence that we also are very clear in our response as the European Parliament as a whole. As members of the Human Rights Committee, we can no longer travel to China. We can also not invite Chinese experts to our committee because they would equally face sanctions. And we cannot rely on the work of think tankers because they are banned from going to China. So when it comes to the Chinese agreement on investment that China wants us to ratify, we may be able to discuss the economic dimension at length, but we are kept by China from discussing its effects on human rights. And I am not willing to let a foreign country dictate me how to do my job as a member of parliament. And I don't think any one of you should accept that. And I'm not sure if we're clear on that across the board. So as long as any one of us is under sanctions, I think this parliament should refuse to even start discussing the CAI, let alone ratify it. Because our commitment to human rights, our solidarity with the Uyghurs and the democratic movement in Hong Kong has to be more important than any potential economic effort, any potential economic benefit market access could have.
She was talking about the investment deal the European Union and China agreed in December. You know, Angela Merkel is still a very strong sponsor of this. Of course, China still wants it to happen, but the European Parliament has to ratify it next year. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. So I guess when you've got Merkel and Xi and Li Keqiang speaking every week, it seems like things might be rosy, but when you listen to the parliamentarians, this doesn't look so good. Joshin, is that something that China's aware of, is the dichotomy in Europe?
I think China clearly realized that. That's why, you know, they're having more and more conversations with the European politicians. But on the other hand, I mean, it's really up to the Europeans. I mean, the China has already made its decision, and it's impossible for China to say, okay, we decided to unsanction the sanctions we have already announced. You know, that would be a huge loss of face, unless, you know, the European would give some very big concessions to persuade China to do this.
Yeah, and I would also imagine that there's no way China is going to renegotiate the investment deal, which is another thing that parliamentarians are saying, that, well, unless we can renegotiate the human rights element of this, we won't vote for it.
Well, it took like 7 years to negotiate this, and it would possibly took another 7 years to even rectify this. Now we are going to go back and renegotiate this, waiting for another 14 years.
Yeah, not much chance of that happening. Thanks a million for joining us, John Carter and Joe Shin.
Thank
you.
My
pleasure.
As critical news stories emerging from China continue to shape lives and business around the world, the weekly SCMP Global Impact Newsletter brings you expert analyses and insights on the economics of COVID-19, society, technology, and the environment. Sign up to receive your weekly email at scmp.com/newsletters.
On Tuesday, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi stepped up efforts to provide emergency COVID-19 supplies to South Asian countries in the grips of the pandemic. Talks were held with Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nepal, Sri Lanka and Bangladesh, but notably absent was India, which is currently dealing with the world's worst coronavirus outbreak. On Wednesday, there were more than 379,000 new cases and more than 3,500 new deaths in India from the virus, with shocking images of hospitals stretched to the very brink and makeshift crematoriums and funeral pyres being beamed all around the world this week. Very sad images indeed. China and India, of course, there's no love lost there. Two strongmen leaders in Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi, and a border row just last year that threatened at times to spill over into a more serious conflict. Joined on the line by Sarah Jung in Beijing, who has been reporting on the diplomatic fallout from this all week. Sarah, what's the official explanation for India's absence from Wang Yi's call with South Asian counterparts?
So the Chinese side said before and during the meeting that China had invited India to attend the virtual talks. And Wang Yi was reiterating offers from China to send aid and support as India deals with this latest coronavirus surge. But India has so far not accepted China's offers to help. And they've instead turned to foreign aid from places like the U.S., its strategic partner in the Quad, and from the U.K. and the European Union. And when I talk to analysts in India and in China, they say that a big part of the reason is that tensions are still simmering over the border conflict between China and India, particularly in the disputed Ladakh region that began to flare up in May and June last year. So even though the troops on both sides have pulled back from one key glacial lake in the region, they're still far from complete disengagement. So there's a lot of mistrust still between the two. And it's under that backdrop that India is more reticent to take part in a Chinese-hosted meeting.
It's really interesting, particularly when we think about how the gravity of the situation, that politics seems to trump health issues there, Sarah. What about for the other nations involved there? I think it was Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh. I suppose they're all more favourably disposed to receiving COVID-19 prevention gear from China.
Definitely. And I think part of it is because India is going through this, like you said, the worst outbreak of the coronavirus in the world. So that means it has stopped exports of the Indian-made AstraZeneca vaccine, which countries like Bangladesh, for example, were really counting on. And Bangladesh is going through its own outbreak. And now that it can't receive these Indian exports of vaccines, it has to expand their vaccine sources to places like China and the US. But all of this gives an opening for China to step in and to say, look, we can give you the vaccines that you can't get from India, which is partly, you know, humanitarian, but also it does deepen their influence in the South Asian region in these countries.
Yeah. And you know, as you said, there are other parties involved here. The United States, obviously, and India are aligned. And the US has been exporting a lot of medical gear to India, as has the European Union and so on. Is there a sense of double standards there, where perhaps the Chinese is viewed as, you know, operating on a mass diplomacy front? And is that same accusation held against other Western powers who choose to engage on perhaps similar terms?
I think it's been clear that there's been vaccine and mask diplomacy from China, as well as from these other places. I mean, as we all saw in the last few days, the U.S. was receiving a lot of backlash because they weren't providing aid to India, or it seemed like they were a bit slow to offer the aid to India. And Chinese state media really pounced on that and said, you know, look, we're willing to offer aid, but countries like the U.S. that keep accusing us of all these different things, they're not offering the same kind of aid to India. So there's a lot of back and forth. And maybe in certain countries, like in India, where there's a lot of skepticism of China, then there would be more charges levied against China for things like vaccine diplomacy. But obviously, on all sides, anyone who's offering any type of aid right now, there is some sort of diplomatic element to that as well.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I suppose for everybody, it's difficult to know where one ends and the other one begins, because we all want everybody to be sharing vaccinations. We want everybody to have access to the right gear. So I suppose it's difficult to really tell what is mass diplomacy and what is just straight up altruism. I wanted to ask you about the general political and geopolitical situation between India and China. You mentioned the military standoff, which was quite serious last year on the Himalayan border region. That hasn't really been resolved. Are the troops still in place there, Sarah? What is the actual military situation on the ground?
So, like you said, at the border situation right now is still quite tense. So even though there was this initial disengagement, there have been subsequent border talks, and there hasn't been sort of a resolution or a process forward to complete disengagement. So in India right now, there's still deep, deep public mistrust of China. And the Indian analysts I was talking to, they were saying, really, there is a long way to go to improve relations. And it's quite difficult now to get back to the point before this whole border standoff happened last year, particularly because of a bloody clash between the two sides at Galwan Valley last June, which led to the first casualties along the disputed border in, you know, nearly four decades. It was a really brutal skirmish that killed at least 20 Indian soldiers, and China said four on its side. So that was really a boiling point for public opinion in India, and things have not really been resolved from there. Even Chinese analysts are saying they're quite pessimistic that even over the next year, things can get better. So that means it's hard for the two to cooperate on anything, including on COVID-19.
Yeah, yeah. And so you said that the mistrust is deep in India. You're in Beijing there. What's the sense of how people in Beijing view India just generally? I mean, is there that same level of mistrust? They're obviously the two biggest and most powerful nations, perhaps just Japan aside, in this region. But generally, what is the sense you get on the ground in Beijing?
Actually, it's interesting when I talk to Chinese analysts and people here, because there isn't as much of a focus on India or South Asia. Really, the predominant issue is China-U.S. relations, or China's relations with the West more broadly. Most people are not really that focused on what's happening with India, even at the height of the border conflict last year, when things in India were at such a high point. In China here, the public opinion was not really focused on that as much, which is interesting. But it's because analysts say that historically, you know, there just isn't that much of an interest below the border, the southern border of China. So it's more about, you know, China's relations abroad.
Really interesting. And Sarah, before we finished up, I just wanted to ask you about how things are there, because you've recently relocated from Hong Kong to Beijing. What's the story in China with in terms of precautions? Are you able to move around freely in terms of coronavirus pandemic containment measures? Back to normal up there, I'd say.
I guess it's relatively back to normal. It was really interesting because I went to a bar the other night and there was a live music performance and people were dancing. There were no social distancing restrictions. So that was really a novel sight for me. But I think in Beijing, there are still more restrictions in place compared to other places. I was quarantining in Shanghai earlier. And in Beijing, when you enter supermarkets or malls, you still have to scan a specific Beijing health code to enter these buildings. But it's really more of a formality since there haven't been COVID cases here for a month.
Great to hear. Okay, well, enjoy your nightclubs. Have a great weekend, and thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks a lot. You too.
Thanks for listening to this week's China Geopolitics podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham. We'll be back next week with the same razor-sharp analysis from the lads on all the big issues of the day. Until then, you know the drill by now. Wear your mask, keep your distance, wash your hands, etc. But we'll see you next week.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.